Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
So has anybody in the room ever, would they want to claim that they have themselves changed the world? Okay. So I think we can establish on the basis of that. Yeah. Hi. It's all right. Yeah. Thank you. I think we can establish on the basis that changing the world, being an individual who can claim to have changed the world, is quite an unusual thing. But we are joined, I am joined, I am joined on the stage by Gina Martin, who is somebody who can claim legitimately to have changed the world.
Not
and
sure about that.
We're going to hear how she did that, why she did that, what is it that inspires someone to do that, and how is it you can go from a initial act of anger or outrage and turn that into something which changes the world. Gina, there may be some people who don't know your story, and so I'm going to ask you to tell your story again. I'm going to want to take you back to a particular day, a particular concert, going to see The Killers, and what happened.
Okay, so July 2017, so it's 25. I was at British Summertime in Hyde Park. I'm sorry for sitting down. I'm just very tired. I should be walking around with Matt. I was at British Summertime Festival in Hyde Park. It was like 6 p.m., broad daylight. I was waiting for The Killers to come on stage with my sister. Forked out like 90 quid to go for like 3 hours. Couldn't afford it, really. And there was a group of guys, like 10 to 12 guys with their girlfriends kind of standing around. It's about a 60,000 strong crowd. And they kind of started hitting on me, and I said no about as many times as I could without starting to get really fucking bored and angry.
And children in the room.
Sorry, really bored and angry and annoyed. And then effectively one of them, without me knowing, stuck his hands between my legs and took photos of my skirt, of my crotch, and sent them to everyone around me. And I didn't see him do it, but I sort of heard them. And you know, you can feel people laughing at you, you don't know why, really. And one of them was in front of me, he was a big guy, and I kind of looked around the corner of him, and he was on his phone, and he'd been sent it on WhatsApp, and it was about 2 inches away from my crotch. It was a really well-taken photo, and I grabbed the phone and kind of held it up and started shouting, and then we got into a scuffle, and then I ran off with the phone through the crowd, kind of knocking people down, trying to get to the police, trying to do all the things you're told to do in those situations. Whenever we talk about sexual violence or sexual harassment, we say, like, well, you should have done this, you should have got a picture, you should have seen the guy, you should have done this. There's a list of stuff you have to do, you know. Tried to do all that. Did it all. Got to the police with the phone, the picture, the guy, and the police said, I'm really sorry, this is awful, but there's nothing we can do about it. Just carry on with your night, because you're wearing knickers. It's not a graphic image. More?
So, okay. No, but and that's a good point to stop. So this would be the point at which I'm just sort of thinking, if you've got everybody in the room, and this is a room of people who are kind of progressive and active in all sorts of ways, I think a lot of people would just to kind of accepted it when it first happened,
yeah.
Right? Okay, and not try to even find a police officer,
yeah.
All right? So you did something that many people would do. You didn't put up with it and make light of it and get on, but you said, no, that's not acceptable.
Mm.
And then when you went to the police and the police said, that's not an offence, that's when I think another half of the room would have thought, okay, well, that's not great, and I'm going to tell my mates about the fact that it's not reasonable. I might even tweet it, but that's the way it is. So what was it that led you not to put up with the fact that it wasn't apparently an offence?
I think it wasn't anything to do that particular day. I don't even think it was anything to do with that particular moment. I think it was a compounding thing of just having brushed this stuff off for literally 10 years. Like, it's not about... We talk about this all the time when we ask women about their experiences or marginalised genders about their experiences. We ask how they felt, we ask what they did about it and how much it hurt and that stuff. But we ask about that one individual experience. We don't see the whole compounding effect of what that experience is, growing up, being shouted at from cars, having your bum slapped in a bar, the casual sexism that kind of happens all the time. And it just grinds you down. And I think that day I was like, I'm not doing this again. Like, I can't even go to a festival with my sister and watch a band and have a nice day without something happening. And I was just really bored of it. I was angry. I was just really, really angry, I think.
Okay, move to that chair so that your back
is... fun. It's like a game.
We're distributing your back.
Hiya.
Okay, so I'm going to really deconstruct this, because I think if other people in the room are anything like me, there have been these moments when you could have done something and you didn't, and I'm trying to find all the particular points at which you give up. Okay, so this point, it's not an offence. You're just an individual. You're not you know, you're not MP's daughter or anything, are you?
No, Scouts, working class family.
A working class family, and it's not against the law.
No.
And so the thing that would stop me now is I just wouldn't know what to do next.
Of course.
What do I do next? I mean, how do I do anything? I'm going to tell my mates about it. I'm angry about it. I might even write to my MP. That's a very old-fashioned thing to do. Mm. So did you have a plan then?
No,
or
not
did
at
you
all.
Just take the next step?
No, this is the thing about trying to change stuff, I think, and campaigning in kind of any regard, is it, if, especially if you're a regular person who doesn't come from, because I'm not academic at all. I scraped by in school. I'm very creative. No political experience, no law experience, no idea what I was doing. You just have to research so hard, get people involved who know more than you and plug your gaps and ask questions and knock on doors. And at the very beginning, when I left the festival and I kind of looked into whether this was illegal and found out it wasn't here, but it had been in Scotland for 10 years and in various other countries, the first thing I did was I put a picture, like a selfie. I'd taken a selfie and these guys were in the background by chance before they'd done it. And I found out my phone and went, okay, that's them. So I put that on Facebook. And I worked in advertising when this was happening. I was kind of a junior copywriter and I knew the power of social media because I'd grown up with it and I was working in it. So I put it on social media and said, like, everyone share this. I want to find out who these guys are because I just want them to feel something because they carried on with the night. They didn't get kicked out. Nothing happened. They've still got the photos to this day. There's probably still photos on 10 of their phones. And I asked people to share that. And then I saw the numbers grow and then Facebook got in contact with me and said, you have to take that photo down because it's harassment against the guys. Me putting the picture of their face is bad, but the picture of my crotch on their phone is not. And that was like a moment there where I was incandescent with rage, but I'd realised the power that social media could have because it had gone everywhere like that. So immediately it was like, okay, so I didn't know this wasn't a sexual offence. Does anyone else know? Right, let's use social media to find out if people know about that. So that was the first step, was kind of an awareness thing online and getting people angry about the same issue I was angry about.
So social media has changed things, yeah?
Yeah,
I mean,
I think
social
so.
Media has changed things, yeah. In the sense that it is possible for one person to create a kind of meme, to create a kind of landslide of opinion. Is there a particular reason why you think that happened? That why it is that you got that your Facebook posting got so many likes or whatever? Or was it because there was an underlying feeling about this issue?
Yes.
So we had the American political scientist Cass Sunstein at the RSA, and he said, you have to understand there are kind of tacit beliefs that exist in society. People believe something,
yeah.
But someone's got to articulate it, and then that belief emerges. Otherwise, you wouldn't even know it was there.
Yeah, it acts as a catalyst. So something people are already angry about. And this was 6 months before Me Too. So there was this kind of stirring online about women's experiences and women having these conversations within their groups, but those groups hadn't kind of exploded into the mainstream yet. That happened at the end of the year when we had the biggest digital conversation about sexual harassment and violence we've ever had. That happened in October, and this, to me, happened in July. But I think, and I hate that thing like, oh, it was good timing, because like, it's not good timing. It happens all the time. It's been happening for hundreds of years. But online, specifically, those conversations were starting to simmer. And when I started talking about the upskirting incident and saying, why is this not a sexual offence? Why did these laws not exist? And also specifically, Brexit was happening. It was brewing, and people were really angry with politicians and felt really disenfranchised. And so when you start a campaign, a regular person starts a campaign, go into politics, I think people really want to see like the regular person give it a go. So I think that was also part of the reason why people were so captivated by it too.
Okay, so we've gone from you being subject to a kind of sexual assault.
Yeah.
You get angry about it, you realise that the law doesn't back you, you then create a kind of social media kind of a meme. It's starting to all kick off on social media. Now, the thing that has to happen now is some connection to the political mainstream.
Yes.
Because there can be all sorts of noise outside the political mainstream, but you wanted the law to change, so
yeah.
You couldn't just do it through activism. So what was the point at which the political establishment started to... You got your connection to that?
So I was doing... I packaged up the social media numbers. I'd said, look how many people are angry about the fact this isn't a sexual offence. That's a great thing about social media. You have the numbers straight out the bat. So you can say to producers of traditional media, which I did for TV, look, people are really angry about this. And they go, oh, there's a market there already. Okay, we'll put this on this morning or whatever on the TV. So I asked them to start having this conversation on traditional media as well. They did that. So I was kind of building an army of people who were angry and basically pressure, so I could then go to a law firm and say, I don't have any money. Could you represent me pro bono? I'm going to go and try and lobby the government. And that was really critical because I think a lot of the time, especially with activism and campaigning, awareness campaigns are fantastic. Like, they do great things, especially for broad issues. They're brilliant. But there has to come a tipping point where you go, I'm shouting about an issue, but I need to get organised now and get strategic. And that the part of that that really worked for me was getting a young, bright lawyer who wasn't jaded by the industry yet, who was 29. I went to all these big law firms and asked pro bono, and also asked specifically how they work pro bono, because a lot of law firms, the heads will go, let's work on this pro bono because it looks good for us to be associated with that issue. Certain law firms will get their very, very young, bright, excited lawyer to choose their own stuff, and that automatically means that the lawyer is passionately involved and they want to do it off their own backs. So I went to Gibson Dunn, who worked that way, and this young, bright lawyer called Ryan said, okay, well, listen, we can go to government and do this, and I can represent you, or we can have a coffee, or I can introduce you to people. But what he did say was that a lot of MPs used to be lawyers and barristers and solicitors. So immediately when you get in with a law firm, you have a connection to politics. And that's kind of how we got our first foot in the room. And then we started building an army across all parties of people who believed in this idea.
OK, so you've now formed a bridge into the kind of political establishment. And it's a really important point, it seems to me, that when we talk about activism, there has to come a point, this point where you go over the bridge from activism into the decision makers, whether or not you like it. And if you don't do that, you're unlikely to make the impact that you want, ultimately. So something else is going to be starting to happen now, of course, in this process, and that is opposition is going to be starting to form. Because whilst you're just an individual and you're on Facebook and all this, then, you know, you're not a threat. But at this point, you're starting to be a threat.
Yeah.
And there are going to be people, right-wing newspaper columnists, trolls, all sorts of other people, who've decided now that you represent everything they most hate about the modern world and feminism and political correctness, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So triggering, this conversation.
So tell us, this is the reason you're doing this is because these forces exist and they're going to bite back. So as you move to this chair, thank you.
It's like you've been ordered around on stage by a man. It's like being politics again.
So tell us about the nature of the opposition you had to face.
So, in politics, there wasn't really a moral opposition to this. Everyone kind of agreed it was a no-brainer. Why is there a gap here? Kids are being upskirted by their teachers. The numbers are ridiculous. We didn't realise. No one was morally, against this. But politically, it started to become a bit of a political football. And that's the issue we have when activists who are regular people or who are going in with a kind of sure thing, this should obviously change, face, because they go in and it becomes a Labour issue. Labour are taking this on because they support women's rights, but okay, Labour can't pass the law, so it can't just be a Labour issue. And then Conservatives are worried about getting involved because it's become a Labour issue and it's a lefty thing and they don't know, it's all about identity politics in those walls as well. So the only opposition was kind of strategic opposition. Well, you've talked to them first, so we need to get you in the room with these people to make sure that they're on side as well. Me and Ryan had to work for literally 9 months to make this a human issue and not a political issue. And the way we did that was by meeting with different politicians, and no one knew who we were meeting with at any one time.
So there's just something, just before you come out.
Yeah, yeah.
There's something really important there, I think. And by the way, if anyone wants to kind of put their hand up, ask a question at any moment. I'm just going through this journey forensically, but do ask questions or whatever at any point. But so this is a big decision, because often people think what you do in a campaign is you choose political sides.
Yes.
That's the way you do a campaign. Yeah. You go, sooner or later, okay, I'm going that way.
Yeah.
You decided to do the reverse, which is to have as broad a possible base as you could, yeah?
Yeah, 100%, because everything is politics, right? Big P politics, little P politics. We get so obsessed with politics, which is, yes, important. We all need to be involved in politics and active in politics. But when we're talking about human issues, it's not a political issue. Upskirting and protecting kids from getting photos taken by their teachers is not a political issue. Defending people's human rights is not a political issue. It is because, in some way, I guess, because certain things are experienced differently by different people in different community groups. But generally, this had to be a progressive new legislation that covered every gender, was fit for purpose for everyone to be protected by. And to do that, we need to get everyone involved in politics and get everyone from every part of the community and in the public backing it too. And as soon as you go to one party and it becomes a red or blue or whatever, people start to form camps, and that can't happen, because this wasn't about identity. It was just about being human and having, bodily autonomy.
So a couple more questions and then we'll move to the kind of general stuff. But then something else happens that in campaign, and you stop me if I'm wrong about this, because I'm just thinking back to it. Something else happens that you don't expect in campaigns that does happen, and that is that something goes off in a kind of weird direction. And the thing that went off in a weird direction was that one particular Conservative MP turned out to be the kind of symbol of opposition to your position. Although he claimed it wasn't to do with the substance, it was to do with the process.
Yeah.
And then he became the subject of enormous amounts of vitriol. So it stopped really being kind of, you know, your issue, and it became, in a sense, about him. So tell us how that happened.
So beginning of the summer last year, so June, I'll actually start with a bit of context and basis. So political process, really, with private members' bills, which is what we tabled. Any MP can table a private members' bill at any point to change law or amend a law. And we tabled one with a Lib Dem MP who was very new to the House, and she'd been there for about 2 months. We'd been lobbying for about 8 months at this point. She was really excited about tabling a bill quickly into her term. So she tabled this bill, and we knew that in Parliament there's about 650 MPs approximately, right? And 649 can agree with an issue and be totally on board and be right behind it, and one disagrees and they can kill a private members' bill. That's just how that is set up, because it's not easy to get private members' bills through, otherwise there'd be 50,000 going through at any one time. So in July, we were on the second reading for our first bill to make upskirting a sexual offence in England and Wales, and we'd worked on this for a year. I'd had a full-time job the whole time. Me and Ryan were knackered. It was such a massive thing to get to. And there was an MP called Christopher Chope, who was a backbench Conservative MP. He's been there a very, very long time. He's a very old guy. And we knew he was going to do... We knew there was a possibility he could do this, so we had 3 days to try and stop him, effectively. And Conservatives were trying to stop him because they were now on board with us and they wanted to change the law too. And they were bargaining with him, and as he is, and what he's like, he just dug his heels in even further every time someone tried to stop him. And we went into the House, me and Ryan. I found out 10 minutes before we went in that he was going to object. And I literally channeled Beyonce while walking down the halls of the Parliament. I was singing Beyonce in my head to be like, I'm so terrified I have to be someone else right now because I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I even here? This place is terrifying. And I went into the House and he objected. He said one word. All the other MPs like shouted for shame. They were like, shame, shame. And that was the bill dead. So it was like, right, so we start again then after a year of all this hell. And we came out the House and he was sitting outside. And Ryan said, you have to go over and ask him why. Like, my lawyer, you have to go over and ask him why. And I said, I don't want to talk to him. I don't want to ask him why. I'm so stressed. This is so hard to deal with. You know, I'm not in politics. I hate this. You know, this is really hard. And he went, I'll come with you. So I went over. And I said, hi, Christopher Chope. My name's Gina Martin. I'm the lead campaigner on the upskirting bill, the voyeurism bill. It was 6th down on the schedule. You objected to it. And he said, which one? And I said, the upskirting bill. And he said, I haven't read it. And I was like, you haven't read it? And I could feel like the heat off Ryan. Ryan was like so angry. And he said, no, I haven't read the bill. I objected to it, but I haven't read it. And Ryan said, do you know what upskirting is? And he said, no, not really, sorry. And I said, okay. Oh, I was like, okay, that's fine. If you'd like to meet next week, I'd like to tell you about that. There's a lot. This bill means a lot to a lot of people. And I left the House. There was loads of media, did like 40 interviews that day about it. It was very stressful. And the really critical thing here was we didn't have one plan. We knew that was not... We'd done our research. We knew that could happen. You have to know what all the options are for this kind of stuff. Politics is very, very complex. So we knew one guy could object to it and it would kill a bill. So what we'd done for the previous 6 months was we'd spent the previous 6 months with the Ministry of Justice getting to know them. There was a three shuffle. So I worked with Dominic Raab, which was an experience, and David Lidington, and then we had a third justice minister who was a female, and she came in and she was really, really brilliant, and she called Lucy Fraser, and she was really supportive. So we'd been working with them for 6 months and building a really strong relationship so that if someone objected, we could go back and say, hey, can you table a government bill, which then goes above all the MPs' heads and they can't object to it. And that's what we did. So we kind of went around him. But that was a really difficult moment for me personally, and I think for everyone who was supporting the campaign.
So two more questions from me, and then we're going to give people a chance to ask a round of questions before we wind up. So you've talked about the stress, you've talked about the challenges, the moments, the opposition. But yeah, also, there is something inspiring about this. You know, activism is full of hope.
Yeah.
How did it feel when it finally went past? How did you feel about yourself? How did you feel about the world when it finally got past?
I just felt, I'll cry though if you ask me that.
That's fine. You're amongst friends.
Am I allowed to cry?
Yes, you are
allowed. Fucking hell. I spent so long trying not to cry in politics. I just felt really excited that regular people can go into politics and change shit, because I'm fucking bored of all of them. Like, I'm so bored of... I'm really like... I'm really angry that the people that represent the country have no idea what it's like to be a regular person on the street. You know, like, you stand in the lobby while they pick up the massive... What's the gold stick called that they walk in with? I don't know what that's... Nice. Thank you. Whatever that big gold stick is that's beautiful and they all love so much. They walk in with that and you're not allowed to look into their eyes and they go in and they do the whole thing. And as I was waiting to go in, this guy walked behind me. This place, you know, it's like Hogwarts on crack, that place. It's just insane. And this guy walked behind me and went, this reminds me of my school. It's like, where did you go? And they're all so privileged. It's so white. There's so much power in that place. And they just don't understand what regular people's lives are like. And so to be able to go in and finish that was wonderful because it was like, oh, we do have a stake in that. And I didn't think we did either until I took it on, you know.
And then final thing is that you've told the story to the room. You're inspiring. She's inspiring. Isn't she inspiring? Yeah.
Thank you.
And I guess the tale that you've told and all those moments will make... I just think there'll be people in this room will do stuff.
I hope so. I really hope so.
But then it's interesting because you keep saying, well, I'm not political and I'm not this and I'm not that. But you've decided to change what you're doing because you've written a book. You've now become someone who wants to point the direction for anyone who wants to be a social activist to make a difference. So in 2 minutes, tell us why you wrote the book. So that's a decision to really change who you are and your identity and your purpose in life a bit. And also tell us, if you had to choose two lessons out of the many lessons in the book, it's a fascinating book, the two lessons you want to share with people about how to change the world.
Okay, so the book is called Be the Change. It's a toolkit for the activist in you. It's basically a book that practically shows you how to start something with whatever you care about. So take the thing you're angry about or the thing that you love that you want to push. How do you start that? Because it's very easy for me to be like, go girls, go guys, come on, let's change the world. But if you're like, I don't know how to write a press release, I don't know how to use social media, and I don't know how to get in the room with important people, that's not going to help. So it's a very practical guide to get you started. The reason I did that is because we are so disenfranchised, we're so disillusioned, we feel so separate to politics apart from voting. And the conversation before is very interesting, but voting is the least you can do. You should vote, it's a given, but you should do a lot more too. And this book shows you how to do that, from how you spend your money to going and changing a law if you want to. And the two lessons I would say from the book, I would say learn about and understand your privilege and your power, your unearned benefits, the thing that give you access, that give you resources, that get you in the rooms with people. Learn about that, because that is your power, and we are so terrified about learning about our privilege, it's really worrying. Learn about that, use it, know how to act on it. And secondly, listen to people. Like, listen more than you speak. I love to stand up here and give my political opinions. I'd love to talk about who I vote for and why I vote for people, but we need to listen to other people's experience more than we need to shout about our experiences, especially as privileged people.
Great. Thank you. Okay, that chair, last time. You have gone full circle. We have gone full circle. We've got time for one round of questions. Who wants to ask Gina a question? Okay, I'm going
around
the room. There's a lady right at the back of the room there. Where's the roving mic? Do we have a roving mic? Yeah, it's there.
We're going over there. I'm sorry, snotting into the microphone.
And then we've got one here.
Hi, Gina.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
Hi, I'm Megan. I just want to say you are an amazing person. You're a very inspirational person.
Thank you.
On the day when your bill was filibustered, I remember in the morning being so excited that it was going to go through and it was amazing. And I was tweeting about it, and then it got filibustered and I was distraught about it. I can't imagine how you must have felt. I emailed the MPs that were involved in that filibuster, and I got the most awful responses from them, being so rude, telling me that I didn't know what I was talking about. And it was... made me so enraged. How did you keep your calm in that situation? Because as women, especially when we respond by kind of showing our feelings and show how mad we are, we get told that we're being hysterical. So how do you keep that composure to ultimately achieve what you want to achieve?
Hold on to that question, Gina, because I've got one or two more. Okay, here.
Hi, Gina.
Hiya.
The Wi-Fi has been limited here, so I haven't checked this, but after a conversation sparked over the weekend, I want to know, is it currently illegal to remove a condom without the knowledge or consent of your partner? And if it isn't, which I don't think it is, would you be willing to take up the charge with us?
Oh, my God. Well, firstly, I'm
hold
not...
On, sh- hold on, hold on, hold on.
Oh, I can't reply, sorry, sorry.
Final question here. Final question here. Here. Oh, hold on, come on.
Hiya. So I've done fair bits of activism, and one of the things I did was organise a protest for the Trump no Muslim ban. And I received quite a lot of trolling and flack and all that kind of stuff. And at that point, I did just burn out. I didn't know how to look after myself. And I was just wondering kind of what you did through this process to take that time to look after yourself so you could keep giving resources to the campaign.
Very good. Okay, I'll start over here. How did I keep my composure? Yes, I have an issue generally with the way that we treat women in with platforms. I didn't keep my composure very well, if I'm honest. I was a complete mess a lot of the time, but I had to not show that in the rooms I was in because I was in the rooms with mostly male politicians. Over time, when you do things that terrify you every day, you tend to grow a thicker skin and you know how to basically act a more diplomatic, different version of yourself, which I did. But there is literally no shortcut to that other than taking stuff on and just giving it a go and being terrified all the frigging time, because I was terrified 6 months of this whole campaign. And it was only about 3 months in that I was able to keep my composure. But having said that, after the trope objection, I did go into the Ministry of Justice in a meeting and just bawled my eyes out in the middle of the meeting in the Ministry of Justice. And we had one woman in that room of 12 men, and she was the person who made the entire rest of the room go, yeah, absolutely fine, should we get drinks? Are you okay, Gina? Take your time, take a step out, let's come back and do the work. Because we need to stop seeing the only type of archetype of power as unemotional and dominating. That is not how it works anymore. It just can't be. So don't not show your emotion, normalise emotion, because you can still do your job and be powerful and cry at the same fucking time. Sorry for swearing. Okay, who was the other question? The condom question. I don't know what the law is around that. I'm really sorry. I've been annoyingly focused on one law for literally the last 2 years of my life. But do the research into law, and if there's anything I do to help you, I will do that to help you. And it absolutely, that should be changed 100%. But if I can help you and join, I will. So Instagram me when you leave. Okay, email me. Come find me. I'll give you my email. Yeah, I'll meet you over there. And the third one about taking care and online stuff. Yeah, I got rape threats for a year. Very, very graphic rape threats for a year. And I couldn't use my, you know, you pick your phone out to talk to your dad and you're getting that kind of stuff. Women in who put their head above the parapet and marginalised genders and marginalised people who do it, it's unbearable the amount of stuff you get. That's a really hard thing to deal with. That was probably the hardest thing for me to deal with during the campaign. There are amazing people doing insane work on this. So there's a charity called Glitch. Do you know about Glitch? I'm sure, yeah, and I feel you. They're started by an amazing ex-Labour MP called Shay Akawowo, who is a black woman who went into Labour and basically got so many death threats she had to quit politics because she couldn't deal with it, because she couldn't like leave her house anymore. That's what we're living in. And she set up Glitch. They do digital resilience training, so you can go and learn in real life how to deal with this rubbish online. You can also do online courses. And also, can we get over the idea that blocking someone is like a massive insult or like using the tools online? I blocked like 700 people. Make yourself safe online and also take time out and watch Harry Potter in your pants and just take the week off because you own this. No one else can tell you how to do it. Take time out. Thank you for those questions.
Okay. So we're finishing now. And you know what I've been thinking of? I've been thinking of this, a kind of Spartacus feel to this, which is I kind of feel... listening to you, we all feel admiration for you, but there's something else, which is we all feel we could be you. Yeah, we could.
Well, I hope so.
We could do it. So I'm going to get. I want everyone in the room. They just go along with this. It's a bit hippie. It's a bit unlike me. Probably won't work. But I want everyone to say, "I am Gina Martin." That's what I want you to do. I want you to like, "I am Spartacus." Okay. All right. On the count of three, I am Gina Martin. 1, 2, 3.
I am Gina Martin.
This is Gina Martin. Thank you.
Love you all. Thank you. Very kind.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.